Hello and welcome to the Rhodes Centre podcast. My name is Mark Blythe and I'm the director of the Rhodes Centre for Economics and Finance at Brown. We're back. We've got a new semester. We've got a new lineup of great speakers. And first out of the gate are two wonderful scholars, Sophia Barta, who's a professor at CUNY, and Alison Johnson, who's a professor out at the University of Oregon. And they're really interested in something we were all interested in 10 years ago, which was credit rating agencies. So the usual story you're familiar with. There was a bunch of stinky mortgages. Those stinky mortgages got stuck into bonds. The people who owned the bonds wanted to get them rated AAA. So they played the agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's and Fitch, against each other and managed to get a bunch of crap rated as AAA. That led to a mortgage crisis and, in many cases, a decade of lost growth. And then they kind of disappeared off the radar. But now they're back. And we're back in this story, which is called Rating Politics, How Sovereign Credit Ratings Reward and Penalize Political and Policy Choices in Prosperous Developed Countries. So welcome to the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm going to give a little bit of a rundown as what I think your argument is. I'm going to ask you to expand on it and then we'll just go from there. So here's how I read this. So it's about the business model, but it's not the pay-for-play moral hazard story that people are familiar with. So rather than inflating ratings to get business in the door, when it comes to sovereign debt, the trick is to ensure that the rating agency in question is insured against unexpected losses. So what they try and do is build insurance into the bond, and they do that by estimating what you call, and they call, a state's capacity for fiscal flexibility. That is, can they raise taxes and cut spending quick to stabilize the rating if some kind of exogenous shock basically makes it downgrade from an A to a B or however it goes? Now, why should we care about this? And this is the really cool bit of the book, because big ratings downgrades for rich, developed, stable, prosperous states in particular are bad for business. We think a lot about Argentina and Venezuela and things like this, but you're saying, no, the action's at the top of the food chain, and it's actually much more determinative than we think. Secondly, because the rating of the state determines the rating of all of the other bonds that anyone can issue in that state. So if the state goes down, Swedish corporates go down, if Sweden goes down, for example. And because, and this is the really insightful thing, I think, big ratings failures tend to lead to big portfolio reallocations. And I want us to talk about that and the impact that this has. So basically, the raters like stability more than they care about accuracy. So the users may think that these are accurate ratings, but in actual fact, the business model is, no, they're just kind of stable ratings, and we like it that way because we're insured against shocks. Now, two consequences follow from this. This is all driven by the bottom line rather than any set of kind of enforcing neoliberal ideas. And it means that austerity emerges at the level of the firm seeking to avoid losses rather than bond market vigilantes or neoliberal economists pushing cuts. So how well was that for a summary of the argument? What did I miss out? What would you add to that? Sophia, let's start with you.
I think that was a very fair summary, but I would just say one more thing about austerity, because you are saying that the rating agencies are implicated in triggering austerity rather than market vigilantes do. But what we are also arguing is that they are already building lower ratings into the system. So they are already penalizing countries that they assume are going to be less likely to go into austerity. So we don't even wait for the actual shock to happen for all of this to play out. Some countries are already lower rated because they are seen as less likely and less able, less willing to do austerity once things happen. And so in that sense, it is a bit even more complicated because these considerations play out even in the absence of a shock. It's literally just an insurance in case a shock happens.
So that's quite startling when you put it that way, because what it suggests is when one of these agencies look at a country, let's take an archetypal social democratic country, and you see high taxes and high spending and all this sort of stuff, they are looking at that. They're looking at it for reasons of how quickly can they save the value of my rating. They're not really looking at the country. But you're suggesting, in fact, that they're probably already down a couple of notches from where they could be, because it's really about baking in the insurance policy rather than anything else. Alison, would you add anything to our summary so far?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, you are the definitive source on austerity. And I think kind of what we try to argue is it's not austerity that they're wedded towards. It's the ability to implement austerity quickly. And so what that ultimately means is they're really paying attention to the policies that would impede the ability to implement austerity quickly, which is not to say that they negatively judge any policies that would potentially require austerity, but governments might theoretically not implement them. And I think that's what really kind of sets our argument apart from kind of a typical austerity narrative or neoliberal narrative that you have advanced, that the devil's really in the details. And, you know, if you're ultimately, you know, ultimately we're putting forth a theory that says rating agencies cover their asses. And this is basically the business model that ingrains policy penalties into bond markets. But it's not austerity per se. You know, there are certain policy items where, you know, if they're massive like they are in the Scandinavian countries, they're not too concerned about it because they know when push comes to shove, these Scandinavian countries will be able to implement austerity quickly.
That suggests to me, putting my sort of, you know, thinking about austerity as I do hat on this one, that you might not really be testing two models in terms of I need to choose between them, that they might go together. So let me break this down a little bit. First of all, isn't prioritizing austerity or the ability to do austerity quickly a very neoliberal idea, right, in and of itself? And when you go through the statistical analysis in the book, what was really interesting to me is that, yeah, absolutely, you know, if you've got lots of taxes and lots of social spending, and particularly pensions or big deficits, unsurprisingly, we've known this for a while, all of that grades down. That, again, seems to ride along with a neoliberal reading rather than challenging it. One of the ones that you point out is an anomaly and is a corporate tax capacity, right? But that could just be simply because no one collects them. So, you know, so long as you're right on the bottom, you've got a little bit more capacity. And similarly, one of the ones you highlight is compensation for government employees gets you a higher rating. Well, putting my evil neoliberal hat on, that could just be me saying, well, you've got plenty of jobs you can cut. So how do you know the difference between the two?
So I think the way we interpreted neoliberalism is kind of like an epistemic ideological commitment to a small state, and that would be motivated by some kind of underlying idea of what makes the economy function well. And what the emphasis that we put here is that this has no connection to what our ideas are about what makes the economy function well. What it really boils down to is this one element of policy, which is not letting markets get cold feet in the case of a shock. So austerity is prioritized not necessarily because these actors think about this as the right policy to follow, but it's simply because market panics create the biggest chance for default. And so in that sense, we don't define this as neoliberal. It has the same effects, but it's not neoliberal approach in the sense that this is not about how the economy works. It's about whether a country can retain the confidence of the markets in the case of a particular shock. And in that sense, what we find is there is this pattern of certain elements of the budget that are being rewarded, as you mentioned, for example, the compensation of employees. And that's exactly the point, that if you have more fat in the system that you can actually cull in the case of an economic shock, that it increases your rating rather than in the case of a neoliberal approach, this would be, you know, something that slows the economy down, whereas for rating agencies, this is some kind of buffer that you can use in the event that something goes wrong.
And I would also kind of add to that, particularly the results for corporate taxation and for public sector employees, this is also kind of a proxy for state capacity, that the state has the capacity to command tax revenues from a public that is willing to be taxed. And, you know, the compensation of public employees being associated with stronger ratings is largely driven by the fact that the Scandinavian countries can tax their populations by 50 or over 50%. And that really reflects a strong fiscal compact. So the fact that that is kind of rewarded, so to speak, is indicative of the fact that credit rating agencies do like strong state capacity. They do like states that have the ability to command higher tax revenues from corporate actors as well as from the public at large.
But let me throw in a counterfactual on this one. If it's essentially the idea is a functional fit and it saves the model rather than it goes with some kind of ideological prior, imagine a world in which countries hit with a shock, the bond rating starts to teeter, the market actors start to dump the assets, they know they're going to have a downgrade they're going to have to deal with. And the government in question comes along and says, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to institute a wealth tax. and we're going to do it on very top earners at 50%. Would that be a good thing? Would the raters go, yeah, great? Because, I mean, if you could find something like that, that would really be proof that it's not any type of neoliberal idea behind it. It's simply a functional fit. Would you think that that was what you would see if that happened in such a counterfactual world?
I can't think of a concrete example of this happening, but my answer is absolutely yes. So for rating agencies, this would be a helping hand from the government. It would actually save their backs in the case of a situation which could very quickly spiral out of control with downgrades leading to market panics and market panics leading to downgrades. So I would say that if a government showed itself able and willing to do that, that would actually be a positive for its long-term ratings. And I think in our case studies, we repeatedly see issues where rating agencies actually caution governments against any attempts to cut taxes. So in that sense, we find a little bit of evidence that they actually are for higher taxes. And when they put lower ratings on long-term high taxes, that's because they are afraid of tax revenues being already fully exhausted even before shocks come onto the horizon.
You know, it'll be interesting to see how credit rating agencies assess, you know, Joe Biden's plans to tax wealth. And I imagine that as a brand new virgin taxation source, this is something that they won't view negatively, right? They might be indifferent or they might be positive, but I don't anticipate it something that Biden would get criticized for.
So that's really fascinating because it really cuts against the dominant narrative that we'd have about these types of agencies and sets them apart from the IMF and other organizations that people write about in this regard. One of the great things you do is you get into the black box of how ratings are done. So what they do, if I get it right, is the following. I have no idea what's going to happen over a 10-year period, and I'm not going to basically take long-term neoliberal principles as a guide because God knows where I'll end up. So the thing that struck me is the following. If you're basically don't know what the future is going to be, a very simple thing to do is a kind of weighted time series of the past.
Yes.
Right? And you just extrapolate it forward.
Yes.
But the only time that you would ever really need to know what's going on is when that time series absolutely fails, when you're in a moment of crisis, right? The situation is no longer stationary. So at that point in time, if you're just kind of trend following, aren't these guys going to get it more wrong by doing that?
So the argument is that this is exactly the time when you need an insurance, right? And so you are trying to just go with the trends, plus you put an extra insurance for when things go wrong. And basically, you only have to insure yourself against negative shocks, not against positive shocks, because what the investors care about when it comes to credit or when it comes to bonds is just the downside risks, right? So that's exactly the point in our book, is that because we can get by with the extrapolating in normal times, we have an extra insurance for non-normal times when, you know, things can go into all sorts of directions, and we have an insurance against the downside. And if some crazy good things happen on the upside, all the better. We are going to gradually upgrade this country, and then we are safe in either direction.
Although I would add to that, you know, one thing that we really bring out in our case studies is how credit rating agencies use structural reform as a proxy, a prediction about how governments might react when that shock comes. Essentially, structural reform is a means of predicting an end. And so governments and politicians and heads of state or heads of government that are willing to engage in that structural reform. This is why, you know, not just the George Osborne's Treasury and Cameron, the Lib Dem conservative coalition got such high marks, but also Matteo Renzi got a lot of high marks. You know, Matteo Renzi was talking about introducing a wealth of structural reforms. And so generally, when you get governments like that, that are really kind of backing behind structural reforms, in the case of Renzi, you know, not at a time of acute crisis, credit rating agencies routinely respond to describing these types of governments as credible, or, you know, they're willing to see this through. So it is kind of a proxy to gauge what things will look like when that trend goes off mark.
So that's fascinating because, I mean, this gets into the kind of performative aspect of this rather than the real thing. Because if we think about structural reforms, if we think about the Osborne period as a period of structural reforms, yes, they said all the right things, and then British productivity completely collapsed, right? And if we think about Italy, you know, Renzi talked a good game, and Monti talked a good game before him, and Draghi's currently talking a good game. Why are people being rewarded for words? Because, you know, is that really all this is? If the words work, that saves the bond rating and therefore benefits the firm?
I think part of this is actually just the confidence fairy argument that people were making, that, you know, we don't actually have to see the outcomes. We just have to calm markets. So I guess part of this is if rating agencies see a government as credibly committed to imposing fiscal pain, then that's enough for their purposes, because it's really market panics that create the biggest risk for rating failure. And so in that sense, yes, it is. It is a confidence game, and therefore words matter.
And I would say on top of that, it's not just words matter, but if you partially commit to what you're saying, I think you get quite high rewards for that. So again, I think the example of Matteo Renzi, he was really praised for his Jobs Act, right? I mean, oh, this is something, Italy needs reform of its kind of fixed contract system. But did he deliver on everything else? No. And one of the reasons why that was the case was because of the 2016 referendum. I mean, he was going big on constitutional reform, and that failed, and that kind of sealed the end of his leadership. But he didn't deliver all the reforms that he promised, of course not, but he did deliver some. And so again, kind of using that as a proxy that, oh, when things get tough, if he's doing this little bit of work in a period of relative calm, you know, we have confidence that potentially he could go further if the times required it.
Basically, this is a test of whether a leader or a government is able and willing to take on vested interests. So if they demonstrate that kind of willingness and ability, then it, you know, counts for them, because when the time comes to do that again after a major shock, they are more likely to be able to show that kind of performance again.
And I think this is also kind of can be seen quite nicely with how rating agencies talk about Theresa May and Boris Johnson's government, how they, you know, these two governments, they said, OK, we care about austerity, we care about our fiscal balance, but we're going to make a huge commitment to the NHS. And this is where rating agencies said, OK, in the midst of fragmentation and minority governments and saying you're going to increase spending on the NHS, you're not committed to austerity. You're not able to cut the deficit.
But that would, you know, I hate to bang on about it, but it brings me back to the how do we differentiate that from neoliberalism? Because ultimately, what they seem to care about is not spending money, keeping deficits down, etc., all of which seems very neoliberal. But you do have a very different argument, which I really enjoyed and really like, about portfolio allocation, which I'm going to sum up in the following way. Sweden matters much more than Argentina to global bond markets, which is wonderfully counterintuitive. Would one of you like to walk the listener through how this whole thing about portfolio allocation matters for these rich country bonds?
So this brings us to the question of why rating agencies are so influential. And very often they are thought to be influential because they are thought to orient the decision of investors. But in actual reality, the way that the rating agencies are used, sovereign ratings are used, is that they help regulate relationships between institutional investors and their clients. And they help to get clients to set the risk-taking limits on the portfolio that is being purchased in their names. And so for those portfolios, especially the ones that are used by the clients that are least able to monitor what's going on, so in terms of pension funds and so on, those actually usually require the highest ratings. And so those ratings have to be very, very, very reliable to shocks. And so if a credit rating fails at the highest level of the rating scale, that's a real disaster for rating agencies, because that undermines their authority across the entire rating scale. And because so much of the institutionally invested funds is actually invested in those ranges, so from the AAA range, AAA to maybe AA minus is the lowest ratings that many of these pension funds and other institutional investors can can even invest in. If those ratings fail, then that really bring a meltdown into the entire market, in the sense that, you know, if there is a downgrade, those portfolios automatically have to be reallocated, because the ratings are baked into the institutional rules. So as soon as those ratings are downgraded, then there is mass sell-off in those rating ranges, and that actually creates pressure for further downgrades, and then an automatic and self-reinforcing spiral starts. And this is important for sovereign bonds, but it also is important for all the other bonds in that given country, because as you were also mentioning, the government is the best borrower in a given country. So if the government's bonds are downgraded, then that kind of cascades through the entire portfolio, so the entire structure of different instruments, not just corporates, but also banking and so on. And so the top ratings are really the most important ratings to not get wrong, and to have complete insurance against these kinds of events.
And I would add to that too, you know, if you're an investor, you have a portfolio, some of that portfolio, you have a high appetite to risk because you want to see if you can really maximize your return. But some of that portfolio, you know, is your kind of safety net. You know, it's the part of the portfolio where you want it to be stable. And so, you know, if you're an investor, you go and buy Argentinian bonds because, you know, you're making a bet on risk and you're trying to see, okay, is this a high return that I could get back? But, you know, the Swedish bonds are your nest egg. They're your safety net. And if those bonds fail, if those bonds then become risky, you're really in trouble.
And that's really fascinating, because I was thinking about this from an investor's point of view. That what does it mean to have a safe asset? Because ultimately, what you guys seem to be saying is, you know, Sweden's probably AAA, but they're going to make it AA just because they're pricing in the chance that it might drop a few. If it drops a few from the already downgraded state, then it could really move fast, and that could have a massive consequence. So it's not safe in the way that we would think about it. But in another way, if I want to buy some Argentinian debt, I mean, come on, they're coming up for their 10th default. They're basically owned by the IMF. I know that I'm chucking good money after bad, but the yield over a period to default could be really high. So why not? This creates some kind of perverse incentives for investors, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think it also highlights the importance of really properly assessing risk for non-risky assets. You know, and I think that was the whole reason why, you know, the European debt crisis took markets so off guard, is they assumed, you know, all these European sovereigns were rated at the high end of the rating scale. They are safe risks. And then all of a sudden they're not, because ratings got things completely wrong. And this is why, you know, you get this panic. And so I think, you know, this, our argument really rests upon, there's huge pressures on rating agencies to rate those safe, you know, comparatively stable assets, and to get those right. Because when they don't get those right, that's when things really fall apart.
I wanted to just jump on this, because when you talk about the investor, you know, making this decision between the Argentinian and the Swedish bond, what is important to understand is that most investors don't, especially the institutional investors, which, you know, account for a large part of the entire market, they are not even able to go into those areas. And so in a sense, yes, Argentina is a safer bet, in the sense that, yes, it's going to oscillate and go up and down, but you know what you are getting into. And the problem with rating failures at the top end of the scale is that, because the most of the funds in these institutional investment is directed towards these highly rated assets, if those funds have to move out of those assets, then suddenly these countries become so-called fallen angels, because they are relegated into a place where there is much less funds to go around them, right? And so in that sense, your intuition is completely right, that probably just from the perspective of market meltdowns, Argentina is a safer asset, but most institutional investors won't be able to take advantage of that kind of logic.
So this is fascinating. All of the risk is being crammed into the safe asset, but it's not really seen as risk.
Yeah.
Right? That's really insightful. I mean, I've never heard of that before. It's a really great insight. I want to go for something trivial, but nonetheless, I think very interesting. Well, perhaps it's not trivial. if you had to line up socialists, social democrats, Christian democrats, and right-wing neoliberals in a line and say which one's going to get the worst score from rating agencies, I wouldn't have bet it was Christian democrats and centrists, but it turns out it is. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think with Christian Democrats, we automatically assume it's not ever going to be downgraded. But you also have the main kind of center-right parties in Spain and Portugal and Ireland are also Christian Democratic parties. And these are parties that are cross-class parties and that have to keep a lot of people happy. And, you know, when you have a cross-class coalition, it becomes really difficult to paint a part of society, because kind of all society falls into your net. And this was the problem with Italy, right? Italy had a Christian democratic government that basically dissolved and was wiped off the face of the planet in 94. But I mean, they had the same issue that when you're, you know, catering to some segments of society with higher spending and other segments of society with lower taxes, it really becomes difficult to keep those cross-class coalitions together if you have to make painful changes about who in society is going to have to suffer to rectify a negative shock.
Similarly, Denmark gets a better score than the UK, the home of at least Europeans neoliberalism. What's that all about?
So with Denmark, I mean, again, it's kind of this notion of going back to a Peter Katzenstein kind of conceptualization of small states in world markets. Small states are effective in world markets because they work together and they're able to weather crisis because consensus is something that can be achieved quite readily. And this is something that credit rating agencies also really appear to value. You know, when elections happen in Denmark, for the most part, they don't care because they know that the right and the left, the Social Democrats and Venstre, are going to work together. But in the UK, when you have a two-party system where you have a majority party that can call all the shots, it doesn't matter if politics is, you know, divisive and polarizing. As long as one party can make all the decisions, you know, that's fine. But then when you have an instance where that party no longer commands a majority of parliament, they rely on other parties to work together, and they come from a tradition where they never work together. They're very acrimonious to other parties. That's when things really hit the fan and where it becomes questionable as to whether these parties will be able to achieve something where they require kind of a broader coalition of support.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I was thinking about something that happened in 2011, which, of course, you remember, which was America got downgraded.
Mm-hmm.
So it went from AAA to AA-, if I remember correctly. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was no downgrade in the Trump period, was there?
Nope.
No, they still have the same rating.
Right. And if the argument is it's about the quality of government and competence in government or whatever, you'd think they would have picked up on that one. So from the point of view of your model, why wasn't Trump a threat?
I mean, he did have the House and the Senate for a brief period of time. And also, I think, so the downgrade, the S&P downgrade of the United States, this is really when the huge standoff over the debt ceiling was happening. And when there was concern that, you know, the Republican Party could potentially hold a gun to the United States government's head and say, we're not going to play along with something that we typically play along with. Now, admittedly, in the 2018 midterms, you did have the Democrats come back and take control of the House. But I also think that the Democrats aren't that same kind of party that's going to put a gun to the U.S. government's head and say, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling because, you know, we want things accomplished and we're not willing to compromise. And so I would say with Trump, it's probably a combination of the fact that his opposition party was a little bit more cognizant of the consequences of not raising the debt ceiling, coupled with the fact that he also had the Senate and also the House, at least within his first 2 years of office.
Or it could be that they're all screaming neoliberals, but we'll just put that to one side. Okay, let's think about sort of how this travels over time. So in the book, your sample period is 95 to 2016. And you note that if you take out the period of the European sovereign debt crisis, broadly 9 to 16, the results totally fine. They're there. But I'm wondering about after 2017, right? Since 2009, but especially since about 2014, interest rates across the world have been basically flat, if not negative. There's currently 17, actually, depending if you add in the COVID stuff, there's more than 17 trillion of negative yielding government debt, particularly amongst the top issuing sovereigns. Central banks have made it plain that nobody who's rich is allowed to make a loss. they will catch all the falling knives that they can. Italy and Greece are permanent wards of the ECB, right? In the sense that, like, so long as they're in recession, they'll keep buying their bonds. So they were never accurately monitoring risk. That's your point. They're basically protecting their business model of ratings. But does that complicate your story in any way? The fact that we now have negative rates, a surfeit of debt, and institutions which basically guarantee losses?
I think our story, and this is really brought out in the case study chapter where we go to 2020. You're right, we are in a new era of low rates, but we're also in an era, a political era, that we weren't really in even before the debt crisis, that is pushing rates up in certain countries. And that is the new political era of populism, where populist parties are now able to enter governments. And you see this very emphatically with Italy, right? I mean, Italy does have the ECB, you know, basically providing it with a safety net when times get tough. But also when the populist five-star Lega government came in, their rates did rise around the time when they announced their budget. And this was something that credit rating agencies also were very concerned about and downgrade Italy over as well. And so I would say, you know, even in these kind of eras of really low interest rates, where we don't think interest rates are going to budge, you still have these unpredictable political events that still can move yields, even in these periods of strong deflation. And credit rating agencies really respond to that, because, again, it's something that makes the future much more difficult to predict.
We're not saying that what they do is going to be equally consequential under any kind of policy regime. But during this policy regime, it's probably less consequential. But at the same time, it also shows what kind of considerations, for example, the ECB or the Fed has to take into account when they change that policy regime, because now they are suppressing many of those consequences that's going on in the rating world. And with respect to that, I actually wanted to also reflect on what you said about the ECB backstopping countries like Italy. So what's really interesting about this is, because of these interdependencies, what we are not seeing right now is how that's going to change the relative ratings, not just of Italy, but also of the countries and the institutions that guarantee Italian ratings. So it's true that Italian ratings are going to be, there is going to be a floor under that, because if they have a guarantee, a de facto guarantee, then they are going to be propped up by the guarantor's rating and the credibility of the guarantee itself. But at the same time, it's also going to affect the ratings of the ECB itself, that they have such a huge guarantee outstanding. And not just that, even if the ECB was to change the guarantee, then it has implications for everybody in the Eurozone, because if Italy was to crash out of the Eurozone because the policy changed, that would have unbelievable ripple through effects on Germany and the frugal four and everybody else. So what I think is the case in this day and age is, yes, we are not seeing such big changes, but those considerations are actually going on in ratings. And I think as soon as the policy changes, as soon as this overarching, you know, monetary glut dries up, we can't really predict how rating agencies are going to you know, price in those interdependencies and those weird, you know, cross financing relationships. So that's going to be really interesting to see.
No, absolutely. I mean, to think of Italy, but think of the corporate sector. If it is the case that you have all these zombie companies on life support, if rates ever rise, they are going to go bang before the banks do. Then it's the banks and then it's the sovereign. And in a sense, that's too big to fail. So we still have those same types of dynamics playing out. And the rating agencies, in a sense, are going to be buffeted around by these forces as much as anyone else's.
Yeah, and that's just inside one country. And because those countries are all dancing together, it's really unpredictable where those ripple through effects might go.
So let's close with this. One of the things that you want to highlight is the ratings reports and ratings is always politics. And let's go back to Alison's example of Five Star come to power. They say, we haven't grown in 20 years. We have some ideas as to why. Some of them are good. Some of them are wrong. Some of them are bad. But our solution is, we basically need to have a kind of universal basic income type thing to shield most of the population, because it's just untenable where we are. And everyone's getting poorer, and basically this is crap. Now, people voted for that, And that seems to be a reasonable thing to vote for. They're not voting for imperialism or world domination. But essentially what you're telling us is there's a bunch of unelected American corporates running around going, you can't have nice things. Now, I'm not going to use the neoliberal word again. I'm not going to go there. But I'm going to say this does sound like kind of you're providing the micro foundations for Wolfgang Streeck. That the Marktwoke, the market people who run things, really do run things. Would you jump into that self-definition? Would you accept that? You're the micro foundations of Streeck's argument?
Well, I think kind of the one half of that argument is that do governments listen, right? And you know, that was kind of the interesting thing about Five Star and La Liga. They did eventually kind of change course due to pressures, not just from market actors, but also from the EU as well. Basically one of our main findings is that credit rating agencies do have a certain preference for governments. But it's not necessarily a right-wing government. It's a government that, you know, can work together, that has minimal checks on its power, and that essentially can govern effectively.
But can I shorten that? Isn't it really what they care about is a government that ensures assets for the investor class?
Yes.
That's really it,
yes.
Regardless of where they reside.
Exactly.
So there's an inherent tension here between democracy as a local form and policies you vote for and what's in the interests of, if you will, the transnational investor class.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we try to engage with that literature on the golden straitjacket, and we do find, yes, I mean, the metaphor that we like to use is that the rating agencies are the strings that tighten the golden straitjacket, because they are the ones who are not only putting penalties on these things, but they are the ones who speak with one voice, right? And so they issue these reports and say, you can't do this or you face downgrades. And so therefore, they are the ones who are issuing the warnings, but they're also the ones who are pulling the trigger on this issue. So yes, we would agree with the fact that there are significant constraints on what governments can and cannot do.
Well, we're out of time. It's been a great conversation. It's a wonderful book. I can't wait to see it when it's out. I think it's the smartest thing I've seen in credit rating agencies to date, and it was a delight to talk to you about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This episode was produced by Dan Richards. You can listen to all our episodes anytime, anywhere, by subscribing to the Road Centre podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Road Centre podcast. Thanks for listening.